Thanks for listening to today's Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and on the line with me from Farmington in Davis County is Brittany Hunter. She's the Horticulture Assistant Professor with Davis County Extension at Utah State University, and we're going to talk about gardening today. And you can send us an email question, and we can address that the following week with Dan Dross, because he'll be on next week. But if you have any vegetable questions, the number, the online address is zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can access it through upr.org. Brittany, thanks for joining me on today's program.
My pleasure.
So I'm always curious about how someone gets into gardening. So how did you get into gardening, and why was that of interest to you?
Well, I always gardened with my family, of course put to work weeding in the garden, but my interest really sprouted from getting a job in high school at a local nursery, and my job was to water the plants and move them around and sell them, and I fell in love with working outside and working with plants and decided to pursue an education in horticulture, and I've never looked back.
So how did you get past the having to weed? And I'm with my own son, it's like that's the last thing he wants to do, where it's always one of the first things I want to do. So was that something you just hated to do like most kids, or you just always liked being outside?
Well, you know, it was hard at times, but I didn't hate it bad enough to quit. I would do my chores.
You got to see by working in the nursery a few more things involved with raising plants other than just the weeding process.
Yes, and horticulture and gardening is just an endlessly interesting world.
I wanted to ask you as we get started, you mentioned that a question, which uses more water, a lawn or a garden? And first, why is that important to know the answer to that question?
Well, I know I've heard, you know, plant food, not lawns. Have you ever heard that?
Yes.
And that's an interesting idea, and it's a great idea. But along with that, we think, okay, well, how much more water is it going to take, or will it take less water? Of course, if we planted a garden instead of a lawn, we're going to be getting fresh food to eat. So maybe it's the water is not the big issue there. But as we have drought events in the state, we are concerned about water use. And in Davis County, where I am, last year we did have some water restrictions, which affected farmers and different things. So we would just like to look at how much water it does take to grow vegetables and fruits. So we have a better idea. There's not a lot of research out there on that.
Are you also looking at the question of work? For instance, if you plant a garden, is that more work or less work than having a lawn?
Yes, that's an interesting point as well. I know from having my own garden that having a garden is a lot more work than having a lawn. you know, with raising the plants, weeding it, picking all the fruit and all of that, but it's definitely rewarding enough to justify the effort.
Well, and I've certainly seen those lawns that have, I mean, mine's not one of them, but those lawns where a lot of care is taken in not only the watering process, but fertilizing and taking care of the insects. In my lawn, I don't do a whole lot other than drag a hose around and maybe put some nitrogen on every once in a while. But some lawns can take quite a bit of work as well. And it seems to be more rewarding to have a vegetable garden than a lawn.
Yes. Yep.
So what are your preliminary results looking like, or have you been able to reach that far?
We are just starting to collect that information. And the information that we collect on how much water people use in their gardens and the information we'll collect at our demonstration garden at the USU Botanical Center in Kaysville will be published in a fact sheet format for people to access through our website on extension.usu.edu. And I would expect that starting next spring, we'll have some of that information available.
And if someone wants to participate, do they just go to that website?
If they're interested in participating or getting more information, I would contact your county extension agent, wherever you may be. And I know the participating gardens in Davis County are master gardeners that that I work with a lot. But certainly we're looking for gardens willing to participate in the program. So.
And is there a title for the project?
Not an official title yet.
Okay, so if they go to extension.usu.edu, how do they search for information?
And we don't have that information up yet. This is just a new grant program that we just received funding, and we're starting to collect data on it. And then I would say next spring, look on the website and type into our Google search bar or click around in our water use for vegetable gardens. So if you go to garden.usu.edu, there should be a tab for vegetables, and that information should be right there.
And while you're talking about it, what's your favorite thing about garden.usu.edu?
Well, it's nice that it's all information catered to Utah. And you can go online on the web and get a lot of information and hear a lot of different opinions about gardening. But when you go to Utah State University Yard and Garden website, everything on there is catered to us, to our growing conditions and our situation here. So.
Okay. You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brittany Hunter is Horticulture Assistant Professor with Davis County Extension in Utah State University. And if you have a question or a comment, send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, and we'll be able to answer that for next week when Dan Drost is in. But here is a question that is in the Zesty Garden inbox. So why don't we just start talking about the garden and some of the issues that people are seeing. This is from Dan and Laverna, and okay. Doesn't say where they're calling or emailing from, but it says, my parents have been successful overwintering spinach by covering the plants with leaf bags and also store their carrots in the ground that way. I have heard about starting onions about now and letting them overwinter. Should you treat them the same way as the spinach, or is there another method, and what variety of onion would you recommend?
That is a good question. I'm not sure I can answer because I haven't tried it myself. But
have you heard of others being able to overwinter their onions?
Uh-huh, yeah. And I would treat it similarly to the carrot. You know, the top will die off, but, you know, you're looking to have a fairly mature onion going into winter and just essentially using the garden as a storage cellar. You know, if you don't have room inside to just keep them outside where it's nice and cool and moist, and they'll keep. So the leaf bags and the mulch to just protect the bulbs from freezing, that I think would work really well. Sure. The white onions tend to do really well storing.
Now, would you have to be concerned about the plant because it's a biennial that comes spring, that it starts to go into seed production rather than in bulb production?
Right, yes. So I guess I'm wondering if they want to store their onions in the garden or overwinter them to store them or overwinter them to grow the next spring.
Yeah, it looks like they're wanting to start onions about now and then let them overwinter.
Right, yeah. And I'm not sure exactly how that works.
Okay, and they do have another question. It says, what exactly is winter cabbage? Is that an overwintered cabbage or just one that is harvested really late in the season?
I'm not sure. I've heard the term winter cabbage, but
a purple cabbage, which tends to grow longer and you kind of harvest it more toward winter?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my thinking would be it's when you plant in the fall or later summer and you can grow it into the beginning of winter, and because cabbage is a cold hardy plant, the light freezes are not going to affect it. In fact, it tends to make cool season vegetables taste sweeter. And so you would be harvesting that cabbage into winter, in early winter. So.
Now, I know personally in my own garden, I'll take cabbage that has been growing in the garden, and along about, I don't know, the end of October, first part of November, I'll dig a trench and I pull the cabbage out by the roots and put the head in the trench, backfill the trench with the dirt with the roots sticking out, and then cover the rest with the bags of leaves. And then I can go out, just like my carrots, and go out in January and uncover the take the leaves off and just pull the cabbage out and take off the outer leaves of the plant. And I've got this beautiful, very sweet cabbage. So I guess it could also refer to that.
Oh, yeah. That's awesome. And I just looked that up to verify, and that's exactly what a winter cabbage is a variety that has a cold tolerance that are started later in the season. And the varieties that are chosen also sometimes have a smaller head that's nice and hard.
Does it suggest any varieties?
The varieties that are mentioned are Huron, H-U-R-O-N, O.S. Cross, and Danish Ballhead. So they're longer season varieties, but they do produce well into winter.
Okay, so. Great. Well, thank you to Dan and Laverna for sending in that email question. And I wanted to ask you about tomatoes. Yesterday, I was in Fruit Heights, and it just started pouring rain. I mean, I've not seen it come down like that in quite a while, especially in July. And then I mentioned that to you before the program started, and you said there's tomato cracking going on. So what exactly is happening there?
Well, it's been hot and dry, and the tomato vines have been growing vigorously, and everything's looking good. But this heavy rain really has given the plants an influx of more water than they can handle at once, and it does tend to cause fruits to crack. So it's really unfortunate. The fruits that are cracking, though, are going to be closer to ripe. You know, if you still have a hard green fruit, those are less susceptible to cracking when you get that heavy rain event.
So does the plant just not know to quit picking up water? It just continues to do it?
Exactly, yeah.
So how do you control that? If I'm just thinking, especially if someone who lives maybe in the Midwest who gets more thunder showers and things like that, or if you live in a wetter environment, how do you keep your fruits from cracking?
Mm-hmm. Well, the cracking does have to do with consistency of water. So if your plants had already been used to having a lot of water, even in Utah where it is hot and dry, you may not see that cracking. I know a lot of our gardens, we go through a dry phase and then wet, dry and wet, and they're not used to this much all at once, and so we do get the cracking. In the Midwest, where they have consistently heavy water, they probably don't get as much cracking. It's more about the regularity of it.
And what other issues are you seeing with tomatoes right now? I'm sure we're all just anxiously, if we haven't gotten them, anxiously awaiting that first ripe tomato.
Right, yep. Ripening green tomatoes is always a big issue. And the heat, the really intense heat, can delay that. But if you have a big crop of green tomatoes on your plant, one strategy would be to cut back your water slightly. And that can sometimes trigger that first red tomato to start to turn. When you do see a pink tomato start to ripen on the vine, it will start to produce ethylene gas, which is the ripening gas. And if you leave it on there and don't pick it too soon, hopefully that gas will spread around the plant and start to trigger the other fruits on the vine to start ripening as well.
So maybe leave the first one or two on there instead of picking them, and I see, and then just kind of get everyone else to come along.
Right.
Do you see much in the way of blossom end rot?
Yes, yeah. Blossom end rot is always present.
And why don't you explain what that is?
Excuse me?
Why don't you explain what blossom end rot is?
Right. Blossom end rot is a calcium deficiency, but what we really notice is fluctuations in watering, just like cracking, when you have extreme dry to extreme wet or vice versa. Somehow that affects the calcium uptake, and you get the blossom end rot on the bottom of the fruit. It sort of looks like a brown or a gray circle. And it's unfortunate because it makes the tomatoes not keep quite as well, and you know, they're not quite as aesthetically pleasing, but the tomatoes are fine to eat even if they have that. So
they're just not, you wouldn't want to take them to a farmer's market or something like that.
Right.
And so you're, again, wanting to have more even and consistent moisture?
Mm-hmm. Right. And one way that we recommend that is to use ground mulches like straw or plastic, or you can use pretty much anything, carpet, leaves, grass clippings, something on the soil surface to shade the soil and to help keep the moisture in. And that will at least help avoid the really severe dry down events and help keep that moisture consistent in the root zone.
Should you have to do anything with the tomatoes as far as at this time of year for like nutrition? Should you be, I would imagine probably now you don't want to really add any nitrogen because you don't want the plant to be getting bigger. You want those tomatoes to be ripening.
Mm-hmm. Nutrition-wise, yeah. Right now, no. Generally, we'll do a fertilizer right when you plant, pre-plant fertilizer, and then right when you start to set fruit. So I guess that depends on where your vines are at. If you're just starting to set some fruit, actually, application of a balanced fertilizer can help give it the boost it needs to start to set those larger fruits and kick into gear. If you have a large vine that's covered in green tomatoes, probably best to cut back on the fertilizer.
Now, I have heard if you're having a lot of green fruit, nothing's just ripening. I mean, this is kind of early still, but in a couple of weeks, if you're not seeing anything, can you cut down into the soil with the shovel on one side of the plant to try to stress it into ripening the fruits it has?
I have heard that. I've never been brave enough to do it. but like I said, cutting back the water a little bit can trigger that. And you're right, a stress on the plant will cause it to say, hey, I need to ripen these fruits so that they'll drop and the seeds will propagate, you know, because it thinks it's going to die, basically.
Have you seen much in the way of tomato hornworm? I've never seen one in my garden, although I've seen the moths that fly around that come from the tomato hornworm, but just not in my own garden. Why don't you describe tomato hornworm and what kind of damage that can do to a plant?
Mm-hmm. Tomato hornworm is a pretty large, chunky caterpillar, and they can really do a number on your tomato leaves.
Are you talking like 3 to 4 inches long?
Mm-hmm.
And like, three-quarters of an inch
them.
Diameter?
They don't go unnoticed very easily because they're pretty fat. But I don't have a big problem. I have chickens that I let roam the garden fairly often, and I think they take care of them.
Well, okay, so there's a question, because I have chickens, but they eat the tomatoes.
They eat the tomatoes, yeah.
So how do you know, keep them from eating your tomatoes?
I just tolerate a few peck tomatoes on the lower levels, but they can't jump and reach most of the tomatoes higher up. So I try to train the vines a little bit higher, out of reach of their beaks.
Although, it says I have raspberries, and I just laughed myself silly because I looked out into the garden one day, this was a couple of years ago, and I saw my chicken jumping into the air. I'm like, what the heck? Mm-hmm. And then it dawned on me that she was flapping up high enough to get the raspberries.
Right.
And yep, she was eating.
My chickens do that same thing, and it's actually pretty hilarious to watch.
They know something good when they see it, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, they do it with the Virginia creeper vine on the fence.
Well, you're listening to The Zesty Garden. Brittany Hunter is the horticulture assistant professor with Davis County Extension and Utah State University. And we're talking about gardening and vegetables. And up next to talk about, I wanted to make sure, though, that we included herbs in today's program, because a lot of the herbs have reached a point where it's probably time, maybe a little past time, to pull them out and to dry them. And I wanted to take a look at that process and make sure that we get out there to our audience exactly how to take care of herbs. So, for instance, I've got some basil that it seems like every time I cut it, the next day it's back to where it was before I cut it. So it's growing really well. How do you take care of your herbs?
Mm-hmm. Well, that depends on your herb. Basil is one of my favorites to grow as well, and pruning is a very important part of keeping the plants growing healthy, and it also helps them bush out so you get a little bit more. So pruning is a good way to maintain your herbs.
So how much would you prune the herbs back? Does it also depend, again, on what kind of herb?
Right. Yeah, basil is if it's sweet basil, is a small little bush. And I'll take off just the tips when it's small. And then once it starts to get a little bit bigger, I'll take off maybe 3 or 4 inches of stem, because it's usually flowering. So I'll take off the flower plus a bit of the plant. And when you prune it like that, it will encourage new buds to break, and it'll just keep getting bushier and bushier and making more leaves.
And as far as, I mean, it's great to use them fresh, but what's the best method for drying an herb like basil?
If you want to dry it, I like to wait until the plant is big and harvest the whole plant at once, so all the stems are still connected, and tie it upside down underneath an awning outside or in a dry room in the house, and that way you've got it all together, and the leaves are spaced out so they don't get moldy. And then once they're dry, you can knock them off into a container and chop it up.
So should you leave the leaves intact until you want to actually use them? I mean, I've heard it releases, if you move them around too much, or it releases the essential oils.
I'm not familiar too much with the science of the oils and that kind of thing, but in my own use, I have, keeping the leaves as intact as I can keep them. They do tend to crumble once they're dry. until I use them.
Yeah. What about freezing them?
That's one technique I've not tried.
Like someone was telling me to put them in ice cubes, and then you can get...
Ooh, that sounds really good.
And
like
then,
mint, if you put mint in an ice cube and then put it in your drink or something in the summer, like a cucumber mint water or something, lemonade.
I'm thinking of a recipe for lavender lemonade, and it would be really great to have some lavender frozen in ice cubes that you could toss into there as well.
Oh, that sounds delicious. And lavender is one of my favorites as well, because it's so pretty in the garden. It's almost, it's as ornamental as it is good for cooking. So.
Now, I know it will be different from one part of the state to the other, but what herbs generally can you overwinter in Utah? I know for you, rosemary, you're probably able to do it. I'm not so lucky up here in Logan. It's just that much colder.
Right. Yeah, rosemary is a little bit tricky, but lavender is a great one. That's hardy to a zone 5. And I know it does great in Logan, because I lived there for 6 years and had a beautiful plant there. Thyme is another one that is hardy and is a beautiful ground cover, comes in a pink flower and different kinds of flowers. Oregano is hardy to zone 4, and is a kind of a spreading ground cover type plant. Let's see. What
and I know
else?
Some of these sage. Readily reseed too.
What's that?
I said some of these readily reseed as well, such as
that's true.
Like some of the mint that you have to kind of watch out mm-hmm. for. And I think I've had pretty good luck with the oregano. I've just had it in a pot, and it starts coming back from seed the next late spring.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about mint since I brought it up. I've got a peppermint that I've got on the northeast corner of my garage, so it actually gets quite a bit of shade where it is, and so that seems to keep it in check. What do you recommend for mint, because it seems to really decide that it owns the place once it gets going.
That's true. I have a spearmint patch as well, and I'm lucky it's kind of out of the way where I don't have any irrigation to it. And there's one way, just don't water it, which would slows down the growth a lot. And I can water it once every other week and keep it alive and keep it growing, but it's not enough water that it can go crazy. So there's one way. Another way would be to grow it in a pot and just never let it touch your native soil. But mints are very aggressive,
and
get out of hand.
Yeah, and make sure to cut off those seed heads.
Mm-hmm. Cut off the seed heads. That's right.
And if you had one herb to grow, what would it be?
It would be basil. I can't live without basil.
So you use it quite a bit, put it into everything almost?
Yes. Yeah. And there's lots of different types. You know, sweet basil is one of my favorites I'll always have, but I'm also a big fan of Thai basil, and there's one called Magical Michael that is really beautiful. It's a beautiful plant, and it has a basil flavor, but it's a little bit different. It's more unique, and that's one I always look for at the nurseries to plant during the summer.
There's one that has a little bit more of an anise flavoring to it, that Purple Ruffles. Won the All-America selection, I would say like 8 or 9 years ago. And there are other purple basils like that give just a little bit different flavor. And that's kind of weird for me because I can't stand licorice, black licorice. But I love this basil that has just a little bit of anise flavoring in it.
I like it too, and it's so pretty. So.
And yeah. Just talking about basil, do you have a favorite recipe that you like to use basil in?
Well, there's a couple favorites, one being tomato sandwiches, a nice layer of basil on my tomato and cheese sandwich.
And is this mozzarella cheese?
What cheese?
Is it mozzarella cheese?
Mozzarella, yeah, or whatever we
have. So you have like a caprese sandwich.
Exactly, yeah. Open face when maybe even a little pesto on there. So that's double basil. So I really like basil. And then again with like caprese, like you said, pasta salad or just a fresh salad, putting basil in that.
I have a recipe that my wife will make that has there's sliced potatoes that end up being baked with a drizzle of olive oil, and I'm not quite sure what else goes with it, not a whole lot, but the olive oil and especially the basil on top. And it's a very simple recipe, but it's so good once these vegetables start coming on to just add basil to everything almost. So
another one that does really well that's perennial is sage, which I find is really yummy with baked potatoes and different kind of winter vegetables and all different recipes. One's pretty in the garden as well as perennial and a great herb to have around.
We put in a sage. It was my parents' home. This was before I was married, so this is more than 20 years ago, and it's still going strong. And the other nice thing about it is that the native insects just love it, and they're all over it when it's in blossom.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, and some people might be thinking of sagebrush, but that's not the one
yeah.
we're talking about.
Yeah, this is something else. Although sagebrush smells really nice, it's not what you want to use in your cooking.
No, yeah, that's the culinary sage.
Well, Brittany, we've reached the end of our time. Thank you for joining me today.
Sure, no problem.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Brittany Hunter is horticulture assistant professor with Davis County Extension and Utah State University. Coming up next is our segment entitled The Green Room with Shane Taylor from Cactus and Tropicals, and we'll look at a favorite houseplant that you should be able to grow. So stay tuned. You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and in with me today is Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City. And he's here to recommend another houseplant, and this one I've never heard of before, a haworthia. Where did that name come from, and what is this plant?
Well, okay, there was a British lord, Adrian Hardy Haworth, that would send botanical expeditions into Africa. And they noticed this specific group of plants that had very unusual growth habits, often with translucent leaves where you could see inside the leaf. They call them window leaves. He found many different species all throughout the African continent, mostly on the southern end, of course, so where it's a little bit drier. And it is named after him. And it's ironic that his middle name is Hardy, because these are very hardy plants. This is a type of succulent that if you're interested in getting into succulents and you want to try your hand at it, this would be a good plant to start with. It is closely related to aloe, although you'll find many stranger looking leaf forms than aloe has.
So when you're saying this is a hardy plant, it's not related to a hardiness zone, just that it's going to take a lot more punishment.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, it's not cold hardy. You wouldn't want to put it out in your garden here, but it is a houseplant that will last even under some really tricky circumstances. So most succulents, because they're from the desert, of course, they need a lot of sun. And that's going to be the tricky thing about cactus and succulents is you've got to have them in a sunny window. Whereas haworthia, because they have a lot in common with aloe, they're often growing in coastal regions with more fog, more cloud cover, and they can adapt to indirect light or to artificial lighting. On my desk at work, I have a species of haworthia that just sits under an artificial light, and it has for almost a year now, and they do just fine. In fact, in a lot of sun, they'll tend to sunburn. They'll tend to get coloration red or even dark black on the leaves if they get too much sun.
I've noticed that it reminds me of hens and chicks because of the way that it's growing in the pot. There's like 6 different little plants.
Yeah, they are clump growers. Like many in the family, they will produce offsets. Or pups. And this specific variety, which is called Haworthia simbiformis, has much more succulent leaves. It's much more rounded, and then it's very noticeably translucent on the tips where you can look down in. And that, those are adaptations. Keeping it as close to the ground as possible means that it's going to lose less water during the dry seasons in nature. And having those open leaves that let more light into the leaf allows it to absorb light even in lower lighting situations. So this is a plant that you can let dry out and you can keep in bright but indirect light, and it will do great. And not many succulents can say that.
Hmm. So you can do it in bright indirect light, or you can keep it in really low light with just a fluorescent light above it. I mean, it sounds like the one that's sitting on your desk.
Yeah.
Seems to be doing pretty well with that. So.
It is doing really well. It's just one of those little LEDs that you can screw into a regular light socket that's only 12 watts, and it sits about a foot or two below that desk lamp. And it comes on every day when I'm there. It's on for 8 hours or so per day, and it's enough to keep it happy and healthy.
Does it have to be transplanted very much?
You know, they do grow, and they grow at a pretty fast rate for a succulent, and they can be divided and transplanted on a regular basis. This one we've got here, you'll notice that the pot is already starting to squeeze out, where it's really taking up a lot of its space in the container, and it's ready to be either be divided or moved up. And if you move it up, it's going to keep spreading out, keep producing pups. If you divide it, it'll take it a little bit longer to start over and start producing those offsets.
So it won't get much taller than it is right now. It'll just spread. So like right now, it's maybe an inch and a half, 2 inches.
Yeah, this tall variety, that's basically as tall as it gets. There are some taller varieties of Horwithia, but of course the tallest being still shorter than about a foot, maybe 8 to 10 inches tall is going to be the tallest variety of Horwithia that I can think of. A lot that trail. There are several varieties that will spill over the sides of the container and trail down, like Horwithia retusa eventually will trail. They're great plants. You don't need to fertilize them. You just water them when they're dry. They are collected because of their really unusual leaf shapes. You'll get many that look like somebody's taken a set of shears and chopped the leaves perfectly flat, and that perfectly flat top of the leaf will be translucent. You'll be able to look down inside the leaf. There are just some really fun varieties of Horwithia.
And this one has a little bit of striping on the underside of the leaf as well.
Yeah, it's got a little bit of pattern. This variety, Cymbiformis, also comes in variegation, sometimes with white or yellow variegation. It's a little bit more rare. You'll find rare varieties of Horwithia on the internet, sometimes selling for hundreds of dollars because people really are into collecting different types and different varieties.
And if you had, what cost are we looking at just to purchase a small one like this?
Oh, often you'll find some of these more common Horwithias in general succulent assortments at your regular grocery store or here at our shop. We bring in specific varieties if we can, or we bring them in with our assortments as well. This guy retails at our store for $5.95.
So pretty inexpensive for a houseplant.
Yeah, absolutely. And something that will continue to live and thrive indefinitely. One of the people I work with, she has an extensive collection of Horwithia, and she brings them in to divide them about once every 18 months to 2 years, and she's always giving starts to other people. I've got a couple starts from her, and they're just fun plants. They're great, unusual succulents that will give you some good texture, some good color.
What will it look like if you are beating it up too much? You talked about if it gets too much light.
If it gets too much light, it's going to start turning red. You'll know they sunburn just like us. They'll get that red blush to the tips of the leaves. And at first, that red won't hurt it at all. Some people actually prefer the plant to have a little bit of that color just because it's something different or unique. If it deepens to like a maroon or a deep, like a reddish black, you know that the plant is moving towards actual leaf damage at that point. So that means it's got too much light. And of course, like any succulent, because their leaves are thick and fleshy, if you poke it or bump it or break it, that damage shows up permanently. And until that part of the plant is overgrown by other parts of the plant, it will look damaged. The most common way people kill their Horwithias is the same as every other plant. They tend to overwater. And these plants tend to like to go a little bit drier. So it's very important to let them go a little bit longer. And that seems to be one of the themes of the plants that I pick personally, because I'm one of those people that forgets. So I have to have plants. I like plants that I can forget about. And this is one of those plants.
Okay, so we're talking about the Horwithia, and Shane Taylor, horticultural specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals, is in the studio with me. I wanted to ask you about your job, because you're a buyer, and that sounds like it'd be awesome, because you could just look at all of these different plants, and of course you've got to think about, all right, so the general public, would they be accepting of this? But I mean, just personally, I think it'd be so hard to choose. Because you get to go out and see all the different things, the different plants are available.
It's a really fun job. It's something that I very much enjoy doing. One of the fun things about working at Cactus and Tropicals is over the years I've got to do a little bit of everything. And so this is my most recent position. And it's fun. Not only do you get to see all these plants, but you get to go out and see all these plants. So I just recently came back from Florida, where I was able to go through these giant growers, huge greenhouses where they're growing these succulents and these ferns and these house plants and in massive buildings and just neat varieties.
So you go down with the budget. So you know what you can bring back and you have to limit yourself.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We always have to stay pretty strict to the budget. It's good and it's bad. Like you said, the general public, you kind of have to buy for that. And that can make it a little bit more narrow because generally the plants that the general public use are going to be stuff like Dracaenas and Pothos and the stuff that are fairly common that we see every day. And the thing that gets us excited, that gets me excited, are those plants that you don't see every day. But one of the reasons that you don't see them every day is they're not going to be super easy to grow. So
maybe every once in a while you bring one of those back, because I'm sure you have some customers that just want to try something different.
Oh, absolutely. And that's something that at our shop that we really try to show off is some of the weird stuff, some of the unusual house plants and some of the different varieties that you can grow. And so we do go out and look for things that you would normally not see at your regular grocery store or your Home Depot or whatnot.
Well, I appreciate you coming in. Thanks for being there for us.
Well, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Shane Taylor, horticulture specialist and buyer for Cactus and Tropicals in Salt Lake City.
Good morning. This is Nancy Williams. Thanks so much for being with me today. I'm going to read you today from another piece by Sue Hubbell in A Country Year, and this one is about bats. Some time ago, a listener had sent a message in saying, gee, it would be nice to hear about bats when I was talking about insects and critters of all kinds. And this is quite a nice essay about bats and why we should be grateful for them instead of being scared and crazy when it comes to them. They really are very beneficial creatures and not at all like their Halloween characterization has been. So here's Sue on bats. She writes, I am an early riser, and now that the weather is warm, I like to take a cup of coffee out under the oak trees in back of the cabin and get a feel for the kind of day it's going to be. Today, the night creatures were still about when I went out there. Katydids, whippoorwills, night flying moths, owls, and mosquitoes. By the time I had a sip or two of coffee and my eyes had adjusted well enough to pick out the shapes of the trees, the mosquitoes had discovered me and gathered in an annoying buzz around my head. But before they had a chance to bite, a small furry shape appeared from nowhere. I heard the soft rush of wings beside my ear, and the mosquitoes were gone. A few moments of silence, more mosquitoes. Once again, a bat swooped in. The arrangement was a pleasant one for both the bat and me. I don't like mosquitoes, but the bat does. I serve as bait to gather the mosquitoes in one rich spot, and the bat ate them before they bit me. For the mosquitoes, the plan was not such a good one. They were kept from dinner and were turned into a dinner instead. All this gives me a fine, friendly feeling towards bats. In their way, I suppose, they also approve of me. The bats are quick, and in the dim light before dawn, it is difficult to identify them, but I believe them to be Myotis lucifugus, more comfortably known as little brown bats. These, at least, are the ones I often see taking their daytime sleep hanging upside down from the rafters in the barn loft. They are common around here and also sleep in caves or hollow trees. Like other bats, they belong to the order Chiroptera, which means wing-handed, a good word for an animal with wings made of membrane of skin covering the hand and the finger bones. But I also like the old English name, a flittermouse, an apt description of our only flying mammal. Bats are mammals like we are. They suckle their young, and they have such wizened, ancient-looking faces that they seem strangely akin and familiar. Yet they find their way and locate their food by using sounds that we can't hear. They hunt by night, and in cold weather some of them migrate and others hibernate. They are odd and alien to us, too, so much that we have made up fancies about them, that they are evil and ill-omened, or at the very least will fly onto our hair. Anyone who's read Dracula will remember that young ladies should not moon around graveyards at night, or they will be in big trouble with bats. The truth is that from a human point of view, bats are beneficial. On the North American continent, the little brown bat and other temperate zone bats have a diet made up almost exclusively of night-flying insects. Further south in tropical regions, there are bats that eat fruit, and even vampire bats, which have incisors to allow them to feed on the blood of large animals. But our northern bats have nothing to do with such fare, eating instead the kinds of insects that are often a bother to us. Bats find their food by producing high-pitched sounds that echo against insects or other solid objects. The echoes return to the bat's ears and give them a precise and vivid aural map of whatever is out there. These cries are beyond our human range of hearing, but when translated to frequencies low enough for us, they sound like a series of short clicks or chirps. The short ultrasound wavelengths allow bats to locate exactly even very small moving objects, such as a mosquito-sized insect. They pluck the mosquitoes out of the air close to my head and would never be so clumsy as to blunder into my hair. What's more, the bats' discrimination is so fine that they can separate the echoes of their own clicks from those of another bat. This is important because they so often fly and hunt in groups, and such accuracy allows them to do so without muddle or confusion. It may not be our way to get dinner, but it does strike me as a wonderfully clever, efficient, and simple way. However, as with most things in life, it's not all that simple, and dinner is not always a sure thing. Night-flying moths are another of the chief items in a bat's diet, and over a long time span of eating and being eaten, bat and moth have worked out a complex relationship. My cousin Asher, whose academic specialty is moth ear mites, has, during the course of a lifetime of work, discovered a good deal about moths' ears, a structure that some of us never knew existed. He tells me that some moths who are night flyers and therefore potential bat dinners can hear the high-pitched noises made by bats and stand a good chance of escaping. What is even more remarkable is that certain moths have the ability to make sounds that the bats in turn can hear. In a sense, they can talk back to bats. "And what," I asked Asher, "do they say?" "They say, 'I am not good to eat,'" he replied. This makes life harder for the bats and easier for the moths. But the moth's advantage is only preserved by a high specialized relationship with yet another creature. The moth ear mites Asher studies, which are a North American species, harm their host's ears, and if they were not careful, they would deafen them and make the moths and themselves easy prey. But they are careful. The mites are tiny arachnids, scarcely visible to the naked eye. When they're ready to lay their eggs, they climb on the moth and make their way to the moth's ear, a safe and protected spot for their eggs. In the process of laying the eggs, they damage the delicate structure of the moth's ear. Since many mites might be present on a single moth, the moth would be deaf if they were to lay their eggs in both ears. So in a stunning example of evolutionary respect, a case where courtesy and self-interest are one and the same, the first mite aboard makes a trail, in a manner not quite yet clearly understood, and all the mites who come later follow her trail, laying all their eggs in the same ear and leaving the opposite ear undamaged. This allows the moth to retain partial hearing and may improve his chances of escaping bats during the time that the mite's eggs hatch. So there we are, out under the oak tree in the dim light. The mites, the moths, the bats, the mosquitoes, and me. We are a text of suitability one for another, and that text is as good as any I know by which to drink my coffee and watch the dawn. Thanks for listening. This is Nancy Williams.